The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Good morning, Long Island, and welcome to DDI on Autism on 103.9 FM, keeping an eye on autism and giving a voice to its Long Island community. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Rome. It's again so glad that you can join us this morning as we share and explore all relevant issues related to autism spectrum disorder. This morning, we'll be continuing our conversation with Dr. Samuel Odom, an author and co-author of over 200 journal articles and book chapters, editor of at least 10 books on early childhood intervention, and accomplished scientific researcher. I'm hoping that a lot of our listeners today will quote a little bit of last week to Dr. Odom, but if maybe you could bring us up to speed for anybody who's just joining the show. We were talking a little bit about your most recent research about using two different approaches on behalf of kids with autism in educational settings. And then we moved very naturally into what it means to use evidence-based practice in applied ways. So why don't we begin right there if we can?
Oh, okay. So returning to the work that we talked about last week in our in middle schools, examining two different types of programs, one that focuses on social competence and developing peer relationships, friendships, and another that focuses on more on classroom participation, flexible thinking, kind of responding to frustrating situations. So that research is occurring in San Diego and in Chapel Hill, and we're going to be in about 78 schools and around six to eight students in each of the schools. So these are middle school, so fifth to seventh grade students, and we expect that the outcomes that we'll see are improvements in social competence for the social competence intervention, in executive functioning for the unstuck and on-target intervention, and then some overlap, we think, in terms of how students make progress as compared to also a control group or a student services usual group that we talked about. So, We had discussed this as being an example of applied research that happens in schools, that where we take strategies or practices that have evidence from the research literature. They appear in journal articles and adapt that information so that it's useful for teachers. So the Peers program and the Unstuck program, those two middle school programs I talked about, have already done that. Those developers have done that, and we're testing out how well that's working as we do our research. For other work that we've done, we've reviewed the autism intervention literature and using pretty strict criteria on what makes up a good research study. And then also strict criteria on how much information is needed to identify a practice as evidence-based. We have identified 28 practices that fit that notion. So by that, we mean these are strategies or practices that teachers could use in their schools, in their classrooms, to address specific goals and individualized goals and objectives for students. So the practices, examples of the practices are just very basic applied behavior analysis practices like prompting, reinforcement, discrete trial training, but also other practices that come that extend beyond what we might traditionally think of as a sort of a clinical applied behavior analysis model. So strategies like naturalistic intervention or functional communication training, mm-hmm. or video modeling. Those are just examples of practices that we've identified as evidence-based. In working with teachers, we have a process where we identify the objective or the goal that a student will have, and from that identification, then we link that a specific practice or a set of practices that could be useful for the teacher teaching that goal, supporting the student in achieving that learning goal. That we very much follow the model that's been developed in evidence-based medicine, and mm-hmm. now is more broadly followed in evidence-based practice, where good intervention instruction is based on that identification from the research about the practices that may be most likely to support the student, but also based on the teacher's or the practitioner's skill in being able to kind of choose and blend that practice, modify, implement the practice in their setting. And then also the students and the parents' priorities for the student about the type of practice that might be used, might be useful. So in evidence-based medicine, evidence-based education, it's sort of a three-legged stool where research is one part of that process. The teacher's skill is a second part of the process, and then the student, sort of the student preferences, like how they might respond to a specific practice, or the parents' priorities about what kind of practice would be used, what type of intervention would be used with their child, is the third sort of leg on that stool, mm-hmm. so to speak.
It helps to visualize it like that actually, and to see that all of that has to come together for success. And I think if I understand what you've been saying, is that there are a lot of really good studies that yield good information, promising information, the possibilities, sometimes in the way of significant results. But they really don't have great meaning unless they can be applied. And there are certain guidelines or not rules, but mm-hmm. precepts that can be applied to make sure that there is success. And you've listed some. How well does a teacher know something like the importance of a natural setting, I suppose, or functional communication? And just lastly, would you agree that it's not a one size fits all? It's not that all 28 are going to be used in a single moment, that a teacher will look at what she's being asked or he is being asked to do from the results of a study, and then have this body of information to refer to. Am I doing this in a way that will promote success? Is that kind of the spirit of this?
Oh yes, I think that's exactly right. When teachers hear that there's 28 practices, the immediate thought is, oh, I have to learn all 28, and that really is not the case. It's an awareness of what mm-hmm. those practices are, but then a selection of a practice that would fit the student's context, their skill, their kind of what the learning goal is for the student. So for example, one of our practices is about exercise and how to engage a student in exercise that may kind of a set of exercise activities that may lead them to accomplish that sort of outcome that exercise often produces for students, for individuals, children with autism. So it may reduce their repetitive behavior. It may increase their heart rate and their physical health. It may broaden the opportunities for recreational participation. One might not think about exercise as being an evidence-based practice, but there are clearly studies that show the benefits for exercise for students. Another example is video modeling. That is, teachers being able to use their smartphones to show the student what an appropriate use of a behavior or a strategy might be, and maybe even capture on video when they're doing it correctly, so that the next time the setting comes up, the teacher could show them what they had done and then what they might do again in that setting.
So. I suspect, Dr. Oldman, maybe you agree that people come to the 28 evidence-based practices with varying degrees and different variation around clinical instinct and understanding. And my mind focused on the idea that we're not necessarily asking practitioners to memorize, but to at least internalize what can be done so that there is a more instinctive response to what's effective. Can we think about that just a moment while we go to the break, and then take that a little bit further as we meet again and conclude? You're listening to DDI on Autism on 103.9 FM, continuing our conversation with Dr. Samuel Odom. Stay with us. Welcome back, Long Island. You're listening to DDI on Autism on 103.9 FM, keeping an eye on autism and giving a voice to its Long Island community. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Romas. Continue my conversation with Dr. Samuel Odom on the subject now of evidence-based practices and what's important to ensure an understanding of. Dr. Odom, we left off and we were just kind of going to that point of how was it necessarily necessary to memorize all the components of evidence-based practice? But we want to be able to cultivate our own instinct as clinicians, as practitioners. So we want that awareness so that it can be a little more reflexive when we're in a classroom or we're working with somebody. Is that the spirit of what we're trying to do in this research?
I think so. It's very important that when we use a practice, that we implement it in a way that it was designed. That is, that the kind of the key elements are used, that the teachers use. And for I mentioned our e-learning modules, which we call AFFIRM modules, and I can talk about what that stands for. But each of those has an implementation checklist so that highlights the key elements that one would use in a practice. So for very basic things like reinforcement, how that's delivered, in a descriptive way, shortly after a behavior occurs. So those are just kind of key features. But one can individualize those key elements based on your style, that a teacher's style of teaching. So that those parts of the practice can occur, but they occur in different ways and different contexts and with different teaching styles.
I really appreciate your adding that, because I did find myself thinking too that there are certain maybe technical characterizations of those. Practices. I mean, something like a reinforcement principle, or But then I wonder, sometimes don't a lot of teachers go into the field because they feel like they have an empathy. They have a feeling for what they do, the kind of softer precepts, so a softer reason. Not to say that that may not be as easily measured as some of the evidence-based practices that we talked about. Or do those practices become are they linked to some of those, again, I have to use the word softer, mm-hmm. those kind of feeling states.
Yeah. I think that the two things come to mind. One is that teachers have very personalized ways of interacting with students. And I think those kind of personal interactions that occur don't affect one way or the other the kind of delivery of those evidence-based practices. Mm-hmm. Well, they do affect one way or the other, because you would want teachers to have positive rapports with students. Yeah. But within that kind of context, I think the teachers can apply the practices in the personal style in which they often interact with the students. So I don't think those are contradictory. We have also in addition to the affirm modules, or these evidence-based modules that I have been talking about, we have also developed an assessment of quality in autism classrooms, autism programs. And I need to disclose that we're publishing that assessment with a professional publisher, and we're not receiving. And Sam, my colleague, and I are the two authors on it, and we're not receiving royalties for doing that, but I need to disclose that future publication. So that assessment, the Autism Program Environment Rating Scale, does, one of the domains is about social climate in the classroom, or how positive the classrooms are. Do you hear positive statements that are being made, or sort of a minimum of negative statements? Does the teacher greet the child when they come in the morning? That sort of, I wouldn't call it a soft soft set of skills, but people do call it soft skills, because they're important for they set the context for the learning that's going to occur in a classroom. So they're really important. But before we leave today, I do want to give the listeners information about where they may find out about the evidence-based practices and the free e-learning modules that we've identified. Again, we don't receive royalties from this. We've had support from the federal government to develop these, so your taxpayer money at work. The AFFIRM, AFIRM, is Autism Focused Intervention Resources and Materials. You can type that into Google and just put AFFIRM Autism, and it will bring our site up. And from there, you can access any of the modules that we've talked about, as well as others that we developed, variations of the modules that we developed for paraprofessionals. Most of the modules, when we originally developed them, were for school age kids from age three to 22. But most recently, we have created another set for early intervention providers. So for birth to three, so to speak. So they've been used by, we've had over 300,000 new users. So individuals who come in and use the modules and they're now translated into five different languages. I was just at a conference in Stockholm, and a panel. There were presenters from Sweden and Poland and China, as well as California, which some people think is another country. So I'd say it's a very much an international presentation. So the modules have been very well received, and we get very good evaluations from the users.
You'd ask, this is important to you, I know, and to me, that we give credit to your colleague as well. And right, so maybe we can let our listeners know that as well.
Yeah. So the individuals I work with at the University of North Carolina who have been part of this work over the years are currently Ann Sam, who is responsible for our affirm modules, Jessica Steinbrenner and Kara Hume, who both have led the last review of our identification of evidence-based practices. In California, Dr. Laura Hall at San Diego State University, Dr. Bonnie Kramer, also at San Diego State University, are the two leaders of our of the research that's occurring in that first study that I talked about before.
Dr. Odom, in the very little time that we have left, let me ask you, where would you like to see this research go next? What's next on the landscape in your work and perhaps with your colleagues as well? Where does this go next?
Yeah, well, the research is accelerating. So the evidence-based practices that we've identified now continue to develop, to be modified. And so I think what I'm hoping will happen next is another update for us. The last review we did was through 2017, and there's a wealth of knowledge that has been published since then. So trying to, I think, update our review using, I think, the standards for research we've learned a lot about. Modifying the standards to reflect current thought about what kind of research is evidence, I think is very important for us next. I think those are the primary directions. We do a lot of research on professional development, so I think continuing to search for strategies to disseminate and convey the information in a way that teachers can use it in their practices is very much a goal for us, and it's a continual goal. It never really stops in terms of kind of next steps. So,
since this is so much about the application of the application of certain precepts, do you see practitioners looking at these evidence-based practices and focusing on some of the ones where they need the most work and having an understanding of what they would want to perfect and make stronger in themselves? Is that one of the advantages of having a 28-point list of the kind of components that lend themselves to success?
I think so. I think they follow the needs that they have for working with students, and in that way, they're following the students' needs. I think that is a very appropriate approach. You know, our teachers work hard. They understand the learning needs and goals that students should have to become independent in schools and to move on to transitioning to be kind of self-determined, independent members of our community. So I think all of this works together. It's been challenging the last few years, certainly with COVID and then just this recovery period, recovery in the sense of schools getting back to being able to operate live. But I don't think that has diminished the need for using evidence-based practices or the interest that teachers have in selecting them and identifying them.
If I recall some of an earlier comment, some of what you're doing here is modeled, is after a medical model, or very similar to a medical model of assessing practices. Is that correct?
Well, we try to not call it a medical model. I think from advocates in the field, they I think react to that notion of autism being a disease that should be cured. Yeah. So we're trying to convey this as a strength-based model where we where the work that we're doing is going to build the strengths for individuals with autism to become self-determined, independent in our society. But yes, we do do assess what those needs are and then try to match the practices to them.
I wish we didn't have to conclude here. I wrote this still more, but I'm going to ask you to come back. You know I am, in the not too distant future. I really appreciate your time. And just last thing, when I was thinking about that medical model, which I would love to come back to, it was kind of mostly about that ongoing debate between the art science stuff of what we do and to be as prescriptive as we can be, which I think is something that's coming directly out of your work. So,
right.
I'm one of many people who appreciate what you're doing very, very much. Dr. Rodham, Dr. Samuel, thank you for your time here. Looking forward to bringing you back.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.